This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today, our show will feature authors. One wrote a memoir about a life-changing experience. The other has written a dozen novels. Both share insights about the Western U.S. We'll start with a sharp contrast to the middle of summer with a discussion about a cold weather sport, dog sledding. Montana Public Radio's The Right Question is a show that features authors from Western states. Host Sarah Aronson talks with Kristen Knight Pace about her memoir, This Much Country. It's her story about hardship, adventure, and the dogs that pulled her sled for thousands of miles.
Kristen, the book begins by introducing your first love story, followed by a divorce, as well as the death of your father when you were just a girl. And one of the first lines that caught my attention in the book is this: "Even at the age of 14, I knew that death was an enemy I needed to keep close." So I want to know, how did that impulse shape your life and your decision-making, and is it still shaping it now?
Oh, yes, every day. I think a huge part of that is death was a part of our life at such a young age, and it made me wonder, starting at age 4 or 5, where do we go and what happens, and everything could just end so abruptly. And so just having that in mind almost every day has propelled me into this life lived at breakneck speed, it feels like, a lot of the time, because I don't want to miss out on something I could have done before I die. My husband can tell you it's kind of an exhausting conversation sometimes, because I'm always thinking of the worst case scenario and how to buy us a little more time so we can accomplish this one more thing. Who knows if it'll all end tomorrow.
Along those lines, you talk about hardship being part of the Alaskan identity, and it was an identity that you sought. What can you say about that now, having left Alaska?
That is the number one reason why we ended up leaving Alaska. It's been a hard battle to come to terms with, because that was such a huge part of our identity there. So proud of what we had become in Alaska, my husband and I, having finished 4,000-mile sled dog races and started a kennel from scratch and homesteaded for a decade and brought 2 children into the world there, along with our incredible kennel of dogs. So I think it got to the point where it was too hard. And we didn't have running water. We didn't have road access for a really big chunk of the year, up to 4 months, sometimes 6 months if it was a really big winter. Where we lived was super windy, and if there was a lot of snow plus all that wind, our road would get drifted in. For many years, we didn't have a snow machine. We just would either walk a mile into our house or ski. It was a huge adventure when we were younger. And we kind of loved the fact that there's this little tiny clan of us back there off Regulus, this road off of the Stampede Corridor, which is pretty famous for the magic bus, the Into the Wild story.
Oh, right.
That everybody knows. So we lived pretty back there, and it was this point of pride to have to struggle so much and haul water in on a sled and get the dogs to haul a big 50-gallon barrel of fuel oil in for the heater. And, you know, it was pretty epic just to survive day to day. And once the babies came along, it was untenable. And hauling water for 35 dogs in addition to ourselves, and bathing babies in little buckets, and all the charm wore off, and we started to get pretty sour on the whole thing. And we realized we weren't happy doing this thing anymore, and that we needed our life to be easier in order to enjoy it.
Yeah, right. Kristen, this book is called A Story of Transformation and Renewal, beginning again with your young marriage turned into divorce. But I want to know about your relationship with your own instincts throughout that loss, and then also what I'm perceiving is kind of the thrill of starting over, with your dog sledding adventure and with Andy. What do you know about your own instincts? Do you feel like you can trust them even having lost?
Yes. That's such an awesome question. I was so sure, as most 18-year-olds are, of, as people might read, this crazy internet relationship that I had that became my first marriage. And I was very stubborn and bullheaded, but also I always went with my gut. That's something to this day that hasn't changed. And so I was really committed to making that relationship work. But there was this inkling in there, I think, and I think this is because of watching my mother go through incredible hardship in raising us, suddenly becoming a single mother of five and being pregnant with twins when my dad died. Always kind of having this inkling in the back of my mind that the rite of passage into womanhood is through really hard things, and that's when your life really begins. That's when you really become who you're supposed to be. Leaping into this relationship at age 18 and then ending up marrying this guy and thinking, oh, we're going to have kids now and then the whole rest of my life will happen. There was always this something in the back of my mind that was like, something bad's going to happen first. And yeah. It did. and thankfully, it led to the incredible life that I was able to depict in this much country. So I'm so grateful for the bad thing that happened. And I'm so grateful that my first husband had the courage to end that relationship. Because like I was saying before, and about being so stubborn, I was determined to see it through and to, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get married and then have kids and then be together forever until you're old. A to B. I'm so grateful that it wasn't A to B for me.
I can't wait to get to talking about the actual mushing part. But before we do, I want to read you a passage and just have you kind of respond to it. Because this book is also a love story. And there's a place in the book where you're falling in love with Andy. And you step outside into a gorgeous rainbow of a solar storm in the Alaskan night. And this is what you wrote. I always had an urge to downplay my pain, to belittle my hardships, to think that they were nothing in the grand scope of horrible possibilities this world harbors. But then, what had I endured to deserve this? This unparalleled magic that was my reality, so much wonder. I sat cross-legged at the foot of it all, a student of the ineffable world, mouth agape, feeling myself grow bigger so I could take it all in. That relationship between knowing the places of pain, but then all of a sudden being receptive to the places of joy and wonder. Like, what do you think facilitated that place of transformation?
The biggest way I was able to accept that was what came first, which was a pretty dismal era of heartache and loss and being kind of forced to sit with it for long, dark months alone in James's cabin, which the readers will come to know. There was no distraction from the heartache. I learned who I was as a person alone, which is someone I had never been. I am one of five children and grew up sharing a room with my sisters and basically went from that to being in a relationship that ended in marriage and then ended in divorce. And so I had never really had a place to myself, and I had never had that intense quiet time to myself to really understand who I was, sinking into that melancholy and that loss and learning to be so patient with it, which I was not a patient person. I mean, I'm still not. But I think that allowed for me to accept the magic that is Alaska, the Northern Lights, falling in love with somebody else, learning to be alone and not afraid to be alone out in the wilderness, but to savor it and to relish it. I don't think all of those things could have happened so fully without first spending all that quiet time working through grief and despair and kind of coming out on the other side of that.
Kristen, I watched a couple of your interviews because I just had to see you at work. And your advice to those who are interested in dog sledding is to start with good dogs. And I have no concept of what it means to make a good sled dog. So can you, what are the attributes of a good sled dog?
Well, in that, I remember that during that video. For us, that meant starting with dogs that a world champion musher had bred. And by that, I'm talking about Jeff King, who has won the Iditarod 4 times, and he's the winningest dog musher of all time. We also knew we wanted to have a really personal relationship with each dog. We took the leap with a handful of puppies from Jeff King and started our kennel. And those puppies are now like the babysitters of our children. Like, they're just so awesome, and they're definitely members of the family. I guess I'll just go ahead and describe Littlehead, because she is one
yes,
of those
good.
Dogs.
Yeah.
Littlehead is the epitome of a perfect, good sled dog to start a kennel with, because she is so independent, and by that I mean totally fearless. I remember the first time that we ran a team with her loose as a puppy, and she went right to the front of that dog team and stayed there the entirety of the run. As like a little 4 or 5 month old puppy, she knew exactly where she was going. She knew exactly where she belonged. It was in the front. And there's all these physical qualities of sled dogs that you want them to have: tough paws, a great appetite, a super positive attitude, a love for their work, and a friendly disposition. And she had all of those things, but she had something more than that. And she and Solo, they had this whole other dimension to themselves that was this drive to go beyond what anybody would ever ask or expect of them. They were willing to take up the harness and lead a team through really perilous situations and times when I was scared and couldn't give the dogs all of the positivity and encouragement that they needed. It was like Solo and Littlehead could pick up my slack and do that for the team. And I remember being at the vet one time and having to fill out some paperwork on Solo, and first thing it says on the paperwork is, "What is your pet's name?" And I was like, "Pet? He's not my pet. He's my lead dog. Like, this dog is my teammate and my soulmate, you know? Like, he's not a pet." I remember just being, like, I almost crossed out pet's name. And it's like, that's just like a, you know, that's not what he is. It's not what they are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Kristen Knight Pace about her adventurous memoir, This Much Country. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. The second half of this program contains some adult language and content. Listener discretion is advised. So you mentioned the Yukon Quest, and you are one of only 31 women in the whole world to complete both the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. And I was hoping you could just start by describing each of those races.
So the Yukon Quest and Iditarod are both 1,000-mile sled dog races. One of them takes place fully in Alaska. That's the Iditarod, and it's definitely the more famous race. The Iditarod is completely off the road system, which means you can only get to the checkpoints by dog sled or snow machine or small bush plane. The biggest distance between checkpoints on the Iditarod is usually about 77 miles, but some years it can be up to 150. It just depends on the route. And then on the Yukon Quest, which takes place in February, 1 month earlier than the Iditarod, it's quite a bit colder and darker. And that race is an international race, so it starts either in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, Canada, and finishes in Fairbanks, Alaska, or it goes the opposite direction, Fairbanks to Whitehorse, just depending on the year. And that race, there are only 9 checkpoints, whereas the Iditarod has 22. So it's quite a bit more self-sufficient to run the Yukon Quest. A lot more camping on the trail, up to 200 miles between checkpoints, and far fewer mushers run the Yukon Quest. So it ends up being a pretty tight-knit group. There's definitely a more of a sense of camaraderie on the Yukon Quest Trail because you're having these big trail-side bonfires with other mushers, and there's only a handful of you. And a lot of times on the quest, you'll hear mushers talk about being on the trail for a week and never seeing another person. Whereas on the Iditarod, it's, you know, up to 80 or 90 mushers in a really good year, and you're always seeing other people on the trail. Very different races, but both incredibly difficult, really, really tough. I mean, there's a reason why they're the toughest, like some of the toughest things you can do as a human and as a dog.
Kristen, do you have your book with you?
I do.
Are you able to read a bit from it?
Sure. So at this point in the book, we are nearly 700 miles into a race. And into the Iditarod, the 2016 Iditarod. So yeah, we've been on the trail for quite some time, and we are pretty tired and trail hardened at this point. You get into a groove being on the trail that long, and it's really just a very repetitive groove of survival. So you're thinking, okay, I have this many more hours to run. I need to try to stay awake and not fall asleep and fall off my sled. And then as soon as you stop somewhere, you bed down your dogs with straw, you feed them their meal, you massage everybody's wrists and shoulders and backs and feet and rub ointment into their feet, and then you finally feed yourself, and then you sleep for an hour, and then you get up and do it all over again. That's the mode that you're in. So what happens next here is really unexpected and pretty much the worst thing that's ever happened to me on the trail, almost. Sarah bent forward against her handlebar and began rifling through her sled bag, headlamp beams swallowed in the swales of fabric. We should have been focused on surviving in 20 below temperatures, on traveling 100 miles a day through unforgiving wild land, on keeping our dogs healthy and exemplifying the pioneer know-how and spirit of thousand-mile mushers. Instead, we were fearing sexual harassment, violence, and rape. Instead, we were fearing what men thought our bodies owed them. How on earth could they watch us go by, these icons of the Northland, driving powerful dog teams, and have the nerve to reach out and touch one of us? Have such a feeling of entitlement over us as to grab one of our asses, to violate. If they could do that to a total stranger, to a professional athlete passing by on a dog sled, what were they doing to the women in their lives, in their schools, in their houses? I turned forward and watched the backs of my dogs, then saw their ears perk up as 6 snow machine lights gathered together and took off up the riverbank. Then came circling back. Under my beaver fur hat, my scalp prickled. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. Behind me, Sarah's voice. I have an axe and a snow hook, she said. Good, I said. They're coming. The machines came from the front and the back. The one behind us caught up more quickly than those ahead, and as the sled came alongside my team, I threw my beaver gauntlets behind my back and unsheathed my sharpened axe. I kept my team in my peripheral vision as I turned to face the snow machiner, heart thumping. I saw the wrinkled face of an old native woman and let out a breath of relief. The snow machines up ahead fanned out and sped past us on either side. They weren't coming for us.
I want the listeners to know that there's a point in the book where snow machines attack 3 other mushers, and one of them is sexually assaulted. And I just want to know, how did that shape your experience as a female athlete?
It was so shocking. And I guess given the history of a lot of the remote villages in Alaska, it shouldn't have been. There's an incredibly pervasive issue of sexual abuse and sexual harassment and rape in rural Alaska. I was worried about moose on the trail, wasn't worried about other human beings being violent. So it was really jarring and incredibly upsetting, and it definitely cast a shadow over the rest of that race for me and for everybody else on the trail.
There's one of my favorite lines in the book comes very late on, and you write, "In the delivery room, my body debuted an awful power." And I was just hoping that you would speak to how motherhood has shaped your sense of your story now.
The awful power of giving birth. I wrote that line because I had read something really wonderful in a midwifery book that really helped me cope with childbirth, and it was that this isn't something that's happening to you. You know, this isn't pain from an outside source that's being inflicted upon you. This is the power of your body, and your body is creating this incredible energy to push this baby out of you. And so it's nothing to fear. It's something to tap into. And that really helped me in the birth of my daughter, Ada. Motherhood has profoundly changed me. And I identified so fully with being a dog musher that I had a really hard time coping with, coming to grips with the fact that dog mushing would no longer define me. And I went through a stage of denial for close to a year where I, you know, signed up for the Yukon Quest with an 8-month-old baby in my lap and determined to run the race as a new mom and trained up a beautiful team of dogs and was more fearless than I had ever been because childbirth turned me into I felt unbeatable. I thought, okay, if I can go through that, I can go through anything. And what's the big deal about falling off a dog sled if I can give birth to a child? Nothing was scary to me anymore. It turned out that I ended up dropping out of that race 1 month before the start of the race. And it was because I realized that I could not leave my family for 2 weeks to be out on the trail. And it wasn't that I felt guilty about it or that I felt like I was skipping out on my responsibilities as a mom. It was that I didn't want to. And so that was really surprising to me. And it took a pretty extraordinary act by one of my really good friends who's in the book a lot, Brent Sass. He convinced me right before the race that we should go on this long training run and let Andy and Ada drive around on this terrible highway, the Elliott Highway, with no shoulders and no cell service, that they would drive 150 miles and meet us on the other side of our run. Just the thought of them being out there on that highway, I was like, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want them to do that. And I don't want to be thinking about them while I'm running my dogs 150 miles and not giving my dogs everything I have to give because my heart is going to be torn in half. And the dogs deserve 100% of me, and Ada deserves 100% of me, and Andy does. I realized that I had to pick one in order for me to be happy. And so I was like, you know, I think I like running my dogs 40 or 50 miles and coming back home and spending the rest of that time with my family being a mom. And it was a really refreshing decision to make, and it really took a lot of pressure off of me, but also it made me realize how much I had changed and that that wasn't a bad thing. It was nothing to be ashamed of.
Sarah Aronson, host of Montana Public Radio's The Right Question, talking with Kristen Knight Pace about her memoir, This Much Country. In addition to running the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest, Pace has been a backcountry ranger and a journalist. You can find out more about her and The Right Question at mtpr.org. Coming up on Main Street, a North Dakota native who is now a successful novelist will talk with Larry Watson about his work and the novel that will soon be a major motion picture. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Mott cattle rancher has been awarded $7,225 by the North Dakota Agricultural Products Utilization Commission for engineering and design of a beef processing facility in Mott. John Roswick owns South 40 Farms. He says his goal is to take his cattle, slaughter them, and sell the meat products online, especially to buyers on both coasts.
North Dakota has great beef. It's a great cattle state. We have great pastures. And I think it's an under-marketed area for us, you know, as a state. And so I want to market our, you know, my beef, you know, outside of the state limits of North Dakota.
Roswick also says he wants to eventually work with other North Dakota ranchers so they too could sell their beef without having a middleman.
So I'll be able to process about 150 to 175 head, you know, per month, you know, when I'm fully, you know, up and running.
Roswick says eventually he wants to sell beef to big box retailers such as Walmart and Costco.
You know, ranchers like myself and ranchers like others, you know, are getting shortchanged, you know, by the big packers.
Roswick says he hopes to break ground on his meatpacking plant within a matter of weeks. A jail inmate who didn't return to jail from work release in Valley City is now wanted for escape. The Barnes County Sheriff's Office says Dell Eagle left the jail on Friday morning and was supposed to return Friday at 10 p.m., but Eagle has not yet returned. Anyone with information on where he may be is asked to call the Sheriff's Office at 701-845-8530. Again, that's 701-845-8530. And North Dakota has seen an uptick in the number of fishing licenses. Around 170,000 licenses have been sold so far this year.
About 23,000 licenses above last year, or the last 3 years. And that's just for resident fishing license. So pretty good shape that way.
State Fisheries Chief Greg Power.
And then we got a couple thousand more non-residents.
Power says he thinks the COVID-19 pandemic has had a lot to do with it.
And that's one thing the governor and our director, Terry Steinle, and others have said, you know, get out and participate. And it's been open for business, and people have had more time on their hands. You know, that we still have relatively high unemployment. We certainly did here a few months ago, so that probably really plays into it. And also, you know, the fishing resource in North Dakota is in pretty good shape, and it will should continue that way for a few years. So I think maybe some people are just, you know, recognizing that, utilizing it.
Power says there's still a lot of time to get out and throw a line in the water.
Even July and August, there can be some good fishing out there.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Gail Shepherd had a book deal, a publication date, and a nearly complete manuscript. Then she pulled the plug on her own novel.
I just started to feel more and more like I wasn't comfortable writing an Asian American character. It's not my background.
Storytelling and culture wars. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Larry Watson, author and soon to be the author of a book that's been made into a movie. He was born and raised in North Dakota, and he joins us by phone from Wisconsin. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's get a bit of your background first, because, of course, we always like to find out about our homegrown people here. Give us your bio and how you got to where you are now.
Sure. Well, I was born in Rugby, North Dakota in 1947. When I was five, the family moved to Bismarck, and so I went to public schools in Bismarck. I attended Bismarck State College. Back then it was Bismarck Junior College, and then went to the University of North Dakota. And at UND, I earned my bachelor's and master's degrees, and I had started on a doctoral program at UND, but then transferred to the University of Utah for a PhD in their creative writing program. And then got a job at soon after finishing graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point in Wisconsin. And that was, I think, 1978. And we've been in the state in different locations since then. I taught at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point for 25 years, then we moved to Milwaukee, where I taught at Marquette University for, I think, 15 years. I retired in 2018, and my wife and I live in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is right between Milwaukee and Chicago, although Chicago claims it as part of Chicagoland, I think, because the metro goes here. And Kenosha is right on the shore of Lake Michigan, and my wife and I are maybe half a block from the harbor.
How many books have you authored and sold?
I have no idea how many I have sold. I should. The book that just came out last week, The Lives of Edie Pritchard, was my 12th book, my 10th novel. I've also published a short story collection and a collection of poems. Of those books, Montana 1948, which was published in 1993, has been far and away the most successful.
Well, the book that we're going to talk about a bit today is Let Him Go. That will be in a movie that will be released later this year, starring Kevin Costner and Diane Lane and other notables as well. Give us sort of a brief synopsis of that story.
Sure. And I'm going to try to say what the story is in a way that is true both to the novel and to the film. There are some differences.
Sure.
George and Margaret Blackledge are an older couple. Their grown son dies in an accident. He's thrown from a horse. And their son's widow and infant son come to live with George and Margaret. But the widow soon meets a young man and decides to remarry. They still live in the same town as George and Margaret. But then they leave. And before they leave, Margaret sees something happen on the street. She sees her former daughter-in-law, a new husband, and her grandson, and sees a bit of cruelty on the part of the new husband. And so Margaret decides that her grandson does not belong with him or his family. They've set out to make a new home closer to his family. And she says to her husband, I'm going after them, and I'm going to try to persuade my former daughter-in-law to let him go. That is to say, to let her son go and to come back to live with George and Margaret. And when they set out on this quest, they run into some difficulties, as you can imagine, with the family in the movie, the family is in North Dakota. In my novel, they were in Montana, a family of troublemakers.
How did it come to be that this novel became a film?
Luck. the filmmaker, Thomas Bazooka, he directed the movie and also wrote the screenplay, had remembered my novel Montana 1948 and liked it. And then he just happened to see Let Him Go on a bookstore shelf, bought it and read it and saw possibilities for a film.
Did you have any input? He was the screenwriter. What kind of relationship do you have once you've written a novel and somebody decides they want to make it into a movie?
Not much. You know, he and I had conversations, preliminary conversations, before the movie got started, and it was plain to me that his vision for a film was not far off from what mine had been for a novel. And throughout the process, he was kind enough to let me know where they were in terms of casting and scouting locations. And so it was fun to be in on the process. But you know, the mediums are so different. I felt I needed to get out of the way. And once I'd written the book, I'd done my work. And when he was making the movie, he was doing his work.
It would seem that when you're writing a novel, a character development is, you know, part of the detail work that you do. And in a movie, casting that role right is probably part of the detail work you do.
Oh, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And he was very concerned about casting, not only so that they fit the characters and who he saw the characters as, but also, of course, for box office and things like that. I mean, they have to think of so many things when they're making a movie.
As you mentioned, your book, Let Him Go, starts in North Dakota, goes to Montana. The movie, I guess, starts in Montana and goes to North Dakota. And I know it was shot in Canada, as so many things are these days, up in the Alberta area. Were you there for any of the filming?
We were. My wife and I both visited the set. Actually, it was, I suppose, a few sets in Canada, a ways outside of Calgary, and they even costumed us and put us in a scene.
Well, how did that feel? And what era is this set in? Is this the 60s or what time period?
It is the early 1960s. My novel was set in 1952. I think the film is set in 1962 or 1963. I'm not exactly sure.
Your books seem to draw from a life experience, at least a sense of place. As you mentioned, you were born in Rugby. You grew up in Bismarck when Bill Guy was the governor. I suspect you note the weather, the kinds of people. How would you say that your life experience is reflected in your novels?
You just named a couple of them. Certainly the weather and the way the weather affects people's lives. I mean, it felt a little strange to begin this conversation without saying, how's the weather in Fargo?
It's pretty nice today, actually. It's in the 70s for a change.
That's wonderful. But sure, the people and how they talk, or as I've sometimes said, how they don't talk, because reticence is certainly a quality of the people in that part of the country. And much of that is remembered for me. I've often said that I write from memory more than from observation. So it's my memory of what those locations looked like and what they felt like.
And your book seemed to cover a time span from the post-World War II 40s into the 60s. Why do you focus on that time period, do you think?
A couple things. One, because I can remember it. I can remember much of the 1950s. I was born in 1947. Also, I mentioned that business about reticence. I think I could go even a little further with that and maybe say repression. That was true not just in the region I've written about, but I think of America during that time when certain things were sort of tamped down, and many of those things had to do with emotion. And that interests me, how when something is pushed down someplace, something else pops up in another. And I've tried to make use of that in my fiction. Although I have to say, in my latest novel, I have made it into the 21st century, and there are cell phones.
Okay, that's The Lives of Edie Pritchard, which was published just last week by Algonquin Books.
That's correct.
I did read a snippet of that. I found it online, and it was very intriguing. It sounds like it's the story of one woman's life, basically, in several stages.
That's exactly right. And I've tried to convey the quality of that life by focusing on events in three different decades. So it begins in 1967, then 1987, and then 2007.
We're talking with novelist Larry Watson. He also writes poetry, and he's the author of a book, Let Him Go, that's about to be released as a movie later this year, starring Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. Larry, how does a book idea begin for you? How would you describe your process?
It varies, certainly. You know, at the beginning of the novel, Let Him Go, this is going to sound very strange, but there's an image. It's an olfactory image, and it's that smell of when furnaces are first turned on in the fall, and that smell of hot dust. And I think I had that image in mind for years. I was out for a walk one day when I was living in Milwaukee at the time. And suddenly I had this thought of a man who was walking home from work and walked past a house and smelled that smell. But years before that, our daughter and her husband lived in a town not far from us when we lived in Stevens Point, and they came to visit us frequently. And on one of those visits, they announced that they were moving, and they weren't moving. They moved to Appleton, Wisconsin, which was a distance of only 60 miles. But I suddenly had this feeling, what would it have been like if our daughter said they weren't moving 60 miles, they were moving 600 miles, and what it would be like to lose, in a sense, contact with our grandson, who was a baby at the time. And so that was a feeling that sort of hung with me. I certainly didn't think I'm going to write a novel about that. But at some point, as it so often happens, a few things seemingly disparate attached themselves. And so I had a character, that man walking home from work during the day in late fall, that feeling of a grandson, a grandchild moving away. And pretty soon the novel came.
When you mentioned the evocative sensation of that furnace turning on, I remembered I grew up next to the oil tank in the basement, and we had water heat, and of course when those radiators heated up, that was a certain odor that went with it. Our senses are so important to us, and I guess writing with skill does, you know, touch those senses, does remind us of that.
Yes, and I think the sense of smell is especially evocative and a kind of nostalgic sense, that we catch an odor and it immediately takes us back to a time and place in our lives.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. When you write, it sounds like it sort of flows. It's not like you've got post-it notes everywhere and it's structured. You've got, you know, where you're going to end up when you start, or how would you describe that process?
Oh, I don't know how it's going to end up. In fact, I know a few pages ahead and not much more than that. If it flows, it flows as a trickle. I'm a very slow writer, and I'm making it up as I go along. I like that way of writing because I'm feel as though I'm open to surprises and discoveries by doing it in that way. But you know, it's a little scary at times.
Do you follow a discipline? Do you try to put in so many hours a day? I assume it's not so many pages because of the process you just described, but do you put your nose to the grindstone, or do you write when you feel the urge?
No, I write every day, and I don't set myself a time limit or a word count or a page limit. But the rule is I have to write every day. And so I approach it like a job. This is my job, and I don't miss many days.
At some stage of the work, especially if you want it published, you have to present it to somebody, and you're probably assigned an editor. How does that process work for you?
Well, sure. Once I finish it, I send it off to my agent, and sometimes I'll already have a contract. Maybe I've had a contract, a two-book contract, and so they're waiting for something. But often I send it to my agent, and then he tries to think of a publisher and an editor at a publishing house that would be a good fit. And so the last two books I've done with Algonquin Books and with the same editor there, and he was right. We're a good fit.
You taught creative writing or literature and writing for many years. What concepts about writing did you want your students to practice or to fully understand?
Well, you know, we talked a lot in the class, in all of my classes, about the different practices and the different things that writers do that help them get the work done. And so early in the semester, we'd often swap stories about what we do. Do you like to write with a pencil? Do you use a pen? Is it a certain kind of paper? you compose on the computer? You like to have coffee? Do you write outside? And part of the idea of that was to hear different practices that work for different writers. And then there was the possibility that someone might say, well, that might work for me. I've always been suspicious of rules or writers who say you must do it this way, because the idea is to get the work done and to find a method, a process that works for you. But sometimes we need to try out a lot of different methods before we do find the one that works for us.
In your practice, do you have like a stable of characters in your mind? I know that sheriffs occasionally pop up in your books. Your father was a sheriff. Your grandfather was a sheriff in the Rugby area, Pierce County. Do places, this mythical or pretend Montana town called Bent Rock shows up in a number of books. Is there kind of a continuity to the way that these books come out? Are they somehow connected in your mind?
Yes, and I certainly didn't set out to do that. I've said, as once said as a joke, that, you know, once you've built that town, once you've built Bent Rock and you know which way the streets run and where the grocery store is, you might as well keep using that location. But it's not that much of a joke. And I think it really is that once you know a place, your imagination is able to work freely, because you don't have to keep constructing where the grocery store is, which way the streets run. And so that's true of, you're exactly right, of my mythical Bent Rock and of my Gladstown, Montana. And really, it is sometimes true of actual places too. So though I might have a Bismarck or a Williston, it is more the Bismarck or the Williston of my imagination than of reality, although the imaginative Bismarck and the real Bismarck certainly share some features.
When I was looking at the film that's about to come out, Let Him Go, there were some stills at IMDb, and one of the stills was very evocative to me because it was a Red Owl store. And, you know, I grew up in this part of the country. Red Owl stores were the supermarkets in most places at that time. Piggly Wiggly's, too. I enjoy movies that remind me of my childhood because we're not that far apart. I'm a couple of years younger than you are. And I, of course, grew up in this place too. So I find these books to be very intriguing and I look forward to discovering them.
Oh, thank you very much.
Larry Watson is the author of many books about our area from Montana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and a time period that, of course, many of us have lived, and those of us who haven't might want to visit it. He's also the author of a brand new movie that's about to come out, of a book that he wrote back in, I think, 2013, Let Him Go, starring Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. Larry, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Doug.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Next time on Clinton.
They believed that he was soft, that he could be pushed around.
He can have horrible things crash down upon his head, but he crawls out from under it and keeps on going.
Clinton on American Experience.
Watch American Experience tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Date Book for July 27th. On this date in 1905, the Hope Pioneer drew attention to the town of Macomber, North Dakota. Macomber was one of the new towns springing up along the railroad lines. The newspaper noted that Macomber was destined to be one of the best towns in northern North Dakota. A planned flour mill would assure the town's success. The town was named for Porter James Macomber. He was born in Illinois. His family moved to Minnesota when he went to school and became a teacher. In 1889, he graduated from law school at the University of Michigan, and he began practicing law in Wahpeton, served as Richland County State's Attorney from 1889 to 1891. Macomber had a long and successful political career. He was elected to the Territorial House of Representatives in 1884 and the Territorial Senate in 1886. The staunch Republican was then elected to the United States Senate in 1899 and served until he lost the nomination to former North Dakota Governor Lynn Frazier in 1923. He served on many influential committees, including the Committee on Indian Affairs and the Finance Committee. He participated in the investigation into the shooting of unarmed prisoners following the Battle of Caloocan in the Philippine-American War. He was a supporter of the League of Nations, Prohibition, the Pure Food and Drug Law, and the Gold Standard. After he left the Senate, McCumber opened a law practice in Washington, D.C. In 1925, Calvin Coolidge appointed him to the International Joint Commission that dealt with the use of boundary waters between the United States and Canada. He served on that commission until his death in 1933. Many of the railroad towns that the newspaper touted as showing great promise faded off the map. The 2010 census reported that the population of Antler, North Dakota was 27. The population of Max Bass was 84. While McCumber is no longer a town at all, the name lives on in the McCumber Angus Ranch. Today's Dakota Date Book, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
So how did Jeff Bezos become the world's richest man?
He's singularly focused in a way that very few of the business people that I've interviewed over the years could possibly be.
The CEO of Amazon testifies before Congress this week about the power and reach of his massive e-commerce empire, how he's transformed his company and his image since Amazon's early days. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, the pandemic is motivating some urban folks to relocate to rural areas. In neighboring Minnesota, Otter Tail County hired someone to promote that idea. And we'll talk with Eric Osberg, the county's Rural Rebound Initiative Coordinator. And Frostfire Summer Theater is up and running online. We'll talk with the director and a performer. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.